20. Arthi. Long after the others had gone to bed and the rain had petered to a stop, Arthi made herself comfortable in an armchair in an apartment on the highest floor above the Nimble Street Bakery. Here, the lamps were doused, and only the soft, cool breath of the moon fell through the wide windows. She wasn't fully certain why she'd come, only that her limbs were restless and wanted to move, and now she was here. On the table by her wrist, a small glass held a number of flowers. None of them chosen for their beauty, but for their significance. Telling a story. Sprigs of rosemary for remembrance. A pair of gladiolas for pride and victory. Asters for patience. Water splashed in the room just beyond. She tried not to listen. She tried not to imagine the way it would pool in the hollow of his collarbones and cascade down the nape of his neck. The way it would trickle down the length of his arms when he lifted them. Arthi. Laith was framed in the doorway. Bone-white hair wet, a pair of dark trousers slung low around his waist. There was a cuff on his forearm that sat loose, a winding length of silver that swelled to the head of a snake, with blue jewels for eyes. He wasn't wearing a shirt. Arthi didn't know what to do with her hands or where to look. She wondered if it was as difficult for him to stand there without a shirt as it was for her to witness him. Why are you here? Not how, only why. In the short time he'd spent with her, he'd learned that she had her ways. He was careful, but so was she. Felix had followed Laith to his apartment the day they'd met in her office, but she never thought she'd actually visit the address. Put a shirt on, she said. It took effort to keep her voice light and nonchalant. We have to talk. He stepped into the room, forcing her to look at him. His feet were bare on the knotted fringe rug. The moonlight ran fingers down his skin, drawing shadows, and Arthi resisted the urge to lean over and light a lamp beside her, not to better her sight, but to see what he would look like bathed in gold instead of silver. Why was he coming toward her? Closer and closer still, each step like a bullet falling into a chamber. If he was trying to intimidate her, then he... My shirt, he explained hoarsely, reaching for the armoire behind her. He tugged open the door and pulled one out, a swallow shifting in his throat before he drew it over himself, muscles rippling from the movement.
Well, appropriate for you?
She wanted to tell him to put his robes on too. It wasn't about him being appropriate. She wasn't an Atenian prude who fainted at an exposed ankle. She didn't care if a man wanted to walk bare in the middle of white roaring square. With Laith, she simply couldn't think. She couldn't focus on the desperation in his eyes and the pain set into his features. She studied him, the steadiness of his limbs, the relaxed stance. Always looking for a lie where there isn't one, Jin said in her head. And she was. It was why she'd survived this long. It was how Arthi had climbed from the filth beneath someone's shoes, just scraping it off her own. Sit down, she said. She had saved his life, and he had saved hers.
I think it's time you tell me the truth.
Laith brewed himself a cup of coffee, and Arthi shook her head when he offered her some. She didn't care for its bitterness. It had none of the comfort of tea. He shrugged and stirred in 5 sugar cubes. At that point, he was having coffee with his sugar. He tipped his head at her waist.
Why don't we begin with that?
This? She pulled out her pistol and focused. It blurred when it shifted, the silver shimmering, the black beckoning. She heard the catch in his breath as Calibor the knife became Calibor the hairpin, pretty enough for her hair, sharp enough to kill. It became a pair of scissors, a bladed star, silver dusters, a dagger. Always a weapon, always bearing that fine dark filigree that reminded her of Laith in a way.
How?
He asked as he sat down on the rug, coffee mug in hand. The first time it had happened, Arthi had been on the run with Jin. She remembered him joking about needing a quieter weapon than a pistol. Arthi wished for it too, and seconds later dropped the sword between them. They each stared down at the thing as if they'd been duped by the other. Neither of them had known how it happened. If anyone were to open up the pistol and look inside, there would be a single bullet in its chamber, despite the fact that she had used it and never once reloaded it. Not only could it shift into any weapon, the pistol could kill anything too, even vampires. Arthi had learned that the hard way when she'd stumbled on Rennie, young and orphaned and under attack in a derelict alley, screaming for help. Arthi had shot at the vampire, hoping to buy time for a getaway. But she'd gotten more than that. Rennie had been too traumatized from being turned into a vampire to remember the incident, but he remained with them after that, and Calibor had never left her side. Over the years, Arthi had cared for Calibor in a way no one really cared for a pistol. It made her stronger, not in the way a weapon typically did, but because it was proof she'd outsmarted an empire. In that way of his, Jin claimed that perhaps, because of how Arthi appreciated it, the pistol had begun to fancy her back. Enough that it would shape itself into whatever weapon she needed. She'd never told a soul aside from Jin. Until now. "Don't concern yourself with how it worked, as much as the fact that it did," she answered. Of everything Arthi expected of him, she did not think he would look away, eyelashes sweeping downward like knives relinquished. "Thank you," he said finally, "for saving me." This time, she looked away. She hadn't expected him to forego his pride and thank her, and she certainly hadn't expected him to sound so earnest. She bit down on her tongue until the pain made her angry. That was the state she had lived in for the past decade, and that was what kept her moving forward. But since meeting Laith, it felt as if she'd lost control of herself. Something was forcing her to suffer one emotion after the next. Exasperation, confusion, distress, and now this. Guilt.
"You all, what you said to the man at the warehouse," he interjected. His kitten crawled into his lap, purring louder than a motor. "When he spoke of your mother."
"Funny that was what you focused on."
Arthi didn't want to talk about her mother. Not here and now in the dead of the night, when memories crawled out of their graves.
"Have you no family?"
Her pocket watch thrummed against her stomach.
"Jin is my family. My crew is my family. Spindrift is our home. If you haven't noticed how dedicated we are to getting that ledger."
Disappointment flickered in his eyes, and something about the gesture gave her pause.
"I watched my mother and father die," she said, softer this time. Perhaps it was the night that made it easier to unwrap truths. "I had no one else." That last sentence was a lie. Between her parents and Jin, there had been someone else, hadn't there? Someone who had cared and taken her in and called her his own, until she'd run away. Did Laith know? When he had voiced the name for a second time in Mateo's house, had he known its significance? The clouds drifted in front of the moon, rearranging him into something darker, less good. She waited, knowing he wouldn't draw information out of her without an even exchange. She might not have known him long, but somehow she knew this. It was his turn.
"I've never liked thrones and those who sit on them, digging graves with a swipe of a pen."
He spoke the words with a quiet vitriol, reminding her that she knew very little about him.
"My king was responsible for the death of my sister. She was all I had. I know what it's like to watch kin die," he continued, in a voice that reminded her of the sea lapping the shore. Quiet,
barely restrained in its resentment.
To be left adrift, a fraction of a whole. To be surrounded by others and no one at once. We are the same, Arthi. We understand what it's like to grieve with fire and not tears. What it's like to do anything for those we love. To grieve with fire.
She did not grieve. Her family, childhood, life. They were gone. What point was there in grief? But you have no one left. He looked at her with a small, sad smile.
Is that not grief? The act of keeping one alive in whatever way that we can?
He slid the cuff up his forearm until it fit snug.
She was everything I had in this world. When I see you and Jin together, it reminds me of what I'll never have again.
She had nearly lost Jin more than once, and then again just today. She had stood on the threshold of loss and stared it in the face. But could she have survived that fall?
She was a Hashashin too, he said,
twirling a blossom between his fingers. It was too dark for Arthi to tell what it was and what significance it held.
And the reason I myself joined the creed, she excelled at everything she touched, rising up the ranks swiftly as a flower unfurling beneath the sun's light. Too swiftly, Latham ended. Our new one-eyed king is clever and ambitious, but most of all, sharp.
Arthi liked this king already.
With the fall of the trees that once cursed our borders, he knew that another danger would fill its place. Conquest.
You mean colonialism, she corrected him. By the people you worked for, was what she almost said. He met her eyes.
Is there much of a difference?
She thought of the boats teetering on Salan's shores, the blood that dyed her mother's sari a deeper shade of red. She thought of the people who remained there now, foreigners in their own homes. No, Arthi decided, there wasn't.
He vowed that Arawia would not fall the way the rest of the world did, Laith said, and dispatched Hashashin to retrieve Hylia, artifacts that could be weaponized against us, and used to challenge him. My sister's talents caught the king's interest, and he sent her here, to Atenia. One girl, barely of age, out on a quest to save his kingdom.
Arthi didn't share his sentiments. If she had been in that girl's place, she would have thought this the opportunity of a lifetime. It would have meant that her efforts had not gone to waste.
She thought it was the opportunity of a lifetime,
Laith said bitterly, and Arthi bit back a smile.
But she was too young to go so far on her own. And though I was still suffering an illness, I joined the voyage. She'd never been to sea. Most Arawians had not, but she caught sickness quickly. By the time we reached Atenia's docks, she was gone. Death is slower across the sea, but he came eventually.
Laith turned the mug in his hands, swishing the remains of his coffee. He blamed his sister's death on his king. He didn't live for the future, but for days departed. It seemed a wasteful way to live, burning fuel over something long gone. You still want that artifact, don't you? She asked, but not for the same reason.
Yes, there's something symbolic about killing a man with what he wants,
Laith said, and Arthi caught a glimpse of a darkness she hadn't thought him capable of possessing. It seemed to her that the King of Arawia had wanted the artifact to protect his people. Laith's sister's death was an unfortunate accident that Arthi wasn't sure warranted the king's murder, but she wasn't about to involve herself in politics. She went still. And you thought the ram could deliver if you did as you were told? He nodded.
I rose up the ranks quickly, and the ram took note.
She thought back to how strange it seemed that he was so loyal to Atenea. How dedicated he was, to the point where it was obvious to her that he had another reason for serving on the guard. Did that sense of purpose extend to retrieving the ledger? Or had he reached the point where he decided the ram had too much power? Arthi couldn't bring herself to ask him. It occurred to her then that the ram might even know the ledger was in the Aetherium, that Laith was partnering with Arthi to retrieve it. When she had left Spindrift for his apartment, she'd been torn about her plan to let him take the fall at the Aetherium. Now, she'd never felt so certain. When Arthi returned to Spindrift, she found a tiny yellow blossom in her lapel loop, fragrant and lonely. A marigold for the heart that suffered grief. Later still, it gave Arthi the courage to knock on Jin's door. By the time she heard the soft laugh, followed by his chuckle on the other side, it was too late. She'd already knocked. It was Laith's fault for letting the ghosts in. The door swung open, its wrought iron accents catching the light. Jin propped a hand against the doorframe and looked down at her with a lazy smile. His shirt was mostly undone, and his hair stuck up every which way. "What are you doing?" she asked with a frown. His brows flicked up.
"Well, I work at this place called Spindrift, and my boss is a tyrannical girl who leaves me with barely an hour that I can get off."
Arthi glanced at him sidelong.
"Get off quite literally? Who is it this time?"
"Arthi!" Jin exclaimed.
"It's Flick. You know it's not like that."
"Couldn't you have stayed 10 years old?"
Arthi flinched. 10 years ago was exactly what she had come to talk about. That past that she hadn't told him about. That family she could have had if she hadn't been afraid and run away. But he was in a hurry and had company. This was a different Jin, and now simply wasn't the time. He sighed.
"What's wrong?"
he asked, leaning closer in her prolonged silence.
"What did you want to talk about that couldn't wait until sunup?"
"Hello, brother. Did you know there's an entire chapter of my life I've never told you about?"
She didn't think he would take that well.
"Take your hour off," she said finally.
She'd been on the fence about talking to him anyway. He'd only help sort that out. She started back down the hall, fingers gliding along the banister to her right, from which she usually overlooked Spindrift's mayhem. Tea room or bloodhouse. The quiet unnerved her. Laith had left his sadness on her shoulders like a coat.
"Arthi," Jin said hesitantly.
"I'll see you in the morning."
And still, she was a little disappointed when he closed the door. She returned to her desk, sat, plans and notes in the wax paper layers of Matea's sketches stared back. She had learned the layout of the Aetherium inside out. A crop of white blonde hair bobbed outside the glass-panelled doors of her office.
"Chester," Arthi called. He threw open one of the doors with more force than was necessary and bounded inside, rubbing an eye sleepily.
His suspenders were slipping down his arms.
"Yeah, boss?
Everything good to go on the tungsten?" she asked. He nodded.
"Ace, come close. I have a special job for you."
He perked up and puffed out his chest, automatically looking around.
"But you can't tell anyone," she said, because she knew what, or rather whom, he was looking for. "Not Rennie, and certainly not Felix. Can you do that?"
Chester hesitated.
"You're still one job ahead of Felix, and two ahead of Rennie."
He nodded.
"You can't tell Jin neither." His deep brown eyes widened a fraction.
Good. She needed him to take the job seriously.
"It's a good thing Jin's busy then," Chester remarked.
Arthi decided she didn't need to discuss Jin's activities with a 9-year-old. She passed him a slip of paper with an address.
"Go there at sunup and wait,"
Keep an eye on the mansion across the street. At 6 bells, the housekeeper will leave for the market, and she'll take a boy with her. They should both be wearing the crest of the Arundel House. It's a letter A, flanked by 2 standing eagles. Follow them. Don't be seen, all right? Talk to the boy. Get friendly enough to get the answer I need. What's the answer you need? Chester asked, following along. Nothing big. Just find out how the master of the house is doing. I don't think he's been home in a while, but I want to be sure. Chester frowned. That's it? Why? Do you know him? Unfortunately. Got it, boss. He clutched the address against his chest as he left. Arthur leaned back in her chair with a sigh, twirling that yellow marigold. The room spun, her desk distorting before her eyes. Just a sip, she told herself, pulling out the decanter from her cabinet and holding it up to the light. There was only a sip left, and she felt as if even nature was her enemy just then. Arthur downed the last of the coconut water and dropped the glass on her desk with a melodic thunk. The fog cleared. What was one more odd stacked against her? 21. Flick. When Flick left Spindrift the next morning, the Casimir crew was still riding high after retrieving the penmanship samples and Aetherium marker. It might have been expired, but it was still a valid marker, which they would need once Jin got in as a blood companion. Despite her true intentions, Flick found herself feeling just as buoyant as the crew, as if she were a vessel in the ocean, intent on going one way before loosening her sails and letting the wind carry her along the waves of its jubilation. I can't, she reminded herself. She was here for her mother, as hollow as the words were beginning to sound. It didn't matter if Jin made her feel things and Chester treated her like a doting older sister. Jin did that to every girl on the street, and Chester looked at Arthur that way even when she was holding a gun. She told herself to focus. She had a job to do now. Markers needed forging. Flick cut down an alley, navigating laundry hung to dry. The building ahead was much like the one next to it, and the one next to that, and on down the street. Red bricks with cracks running up the mortar. A bell at the very top for shift changes. Weeds overgrown and snarling across what was once a paved path. Smokestacks rose every so often, like fingers in the mist. The foundries of white roaring. Young ladies her age marched nowhere without a chaperone. But once Flick had begun forging, that had changed. She couldn't have a chaperone tagging along the back roads of white roaring. And though it had been years since those first escapades, Flick still hadn't grown accustomed to being alone. She swept through the muck, remembering the last time she'd come here, for the signet ring that had ruined her life. The place was doorless and dark, like the many glassless windows cut into the brick face, but the sound of metal on metal clashed with men and children yelling over roaring fires from deep inside. Workers of all ages, down to boys and girls no older than 8 years old, carried shovels and hefted crates. They scattered coal and passed about green sand. The place glowed orange and gold, as smoke and steam rose in equal protest above vats of angry red. The weight of her clothes itched against the rivers of perspiration dripping down her skin, and Flick gagged from the fumes. White roaring was pumped full of foundries, enough that the entire city smelled faintly of them, but here it was concentrated. The stench would take days to get out of her lungs, as attached to her skin as the memories of the day when she'd last come around. "Excuse me, miss," a boy exclaimed, squeezing past her with a bucket of water sloshing by his side. "Wait," she called, but he was already limping away, leaving little puddles that reflected the many pulleys swaying from above. She searched for the foreman, hurrying past a bellowing furnace before she stumbled on the man she needed. "Raise!" She was relieved to see a familiar face, even if it was his. He wiped his sooty hands on the front of his apron and turned. His face contorted almost immediately, blistering anger rearranging his bold features.
You, he snarled.
His salt and pepper moustache quivered. Flick took a couple steps back, nearly tripping over a boy scooping coal out of a barrel. Terror shot through her. Reyes wasn't the most pleasant of men, but he'd never been vehement.
Reyes, it's me, Flick, she said. You helped me not long ago, and I'd like to use your machinery again.
He barked a laugh, the sound dragging a chill down her spine. A willowy man came up beside him. Too tall, his second. He was tapping a poker against his palm, and Flick took another very careful step back. She did not think she'd ever felt fear this acute, turning her sweat to ice.
You got some cheek showing up here again, Too Tall hissed.
Without warning, he swung the poker with enough force to shatter her ribs. Flick threw up her arms and shrank away, but she knew it was hopeless. She knew she was a fool for taking on this job, for thinking she could trim her name to something worthy of the streets and do something as grand as double-cross Arthi Casimir for her mother's forgiveness. The steel struck something with a clang.
Now, that's no way to treat a lady.
Flick opened her eyes at the low words to find Jin towering between her and the two foremen, his umbrella holding back Too Tall's poker. He wore a black surgical mask over the lower half of his face, dark bands looped around his ears. What she could see of his features was set in stone, the glow of the factory lighting his profile gold. He was looking at her as if there were no angry, violent men before him, as if it was only the two of them in the world. Did he hurt you? Flick didn't know how to respond to the pure fury in his eyes. Did he touch you? Jin asked again. She shook her head.
Casimir? Reyes said, voice mellowing with what Flick realized was respect. This isn't no lady.
He lifted his right hand and wriggled his fingers, four of them, because the smallest was missing. Flick gasped. Jin tilted his head.
This is what she did after taking advantage of my kindness, Reyes continued. I let her use my facilities, and this is how I was repaid.
Flick lowered her arms.
That isn't true. You're mistaken.
The words rushed out of her.
You helped me forge that ring. Why would I hurt you in return?
Only her mother knew she'd come here. Flick had been careful not to leave a trace behind, and she'd assured her mother as much.
You can't hurt a fly, woman. Those cloaked fiends did your dirty work. I'd have lost worse if it hadn't been for my men, Reyes sneered, and Too Tall pulled back the poker for another attack.
Flick was about to scream before Jin swung his umbrella again. Up until this moment, she'd assumed the umbrella was part of his attire, part of his spruce and snappy look. What a fool she was. Jin cracked the umbrella across Too Tall's knuckles, breaking his hold, then struck him twice more, too quick for Flick to follow. Too Tall screamed and dropped to his knees. Broken. Flick's breath shook, and Reyes went still. Too Tall's rod rolled across the stone floor, and the shadows cutting through the coppery trusses above drew an X on his face. Jin waited until his howls quieted.
Now that we can see eye to eye, he said, listen well. She,
he pointed at her with his umbrella, is under my protection. He looked around at the men that had gathered around them. The foundry exhaled and bubbled eerily without the voices to accompany it.
Touch her, and you will all die.
Have I made myself clear? No one breathed.
Have I made myself clear?
Jin repeated louder this time. She flinched at the cold menace in his voice. He rapped his umbrella on the side of a barrel sharply, and the murmurs were instant. Flick saw the way the foundryman looked at her then, the shift in their gazes, the anger glittering beneath the respect forced upon them. She didn't want to be regarded with fear. These were good working men. If she'd brought danger to their doorstep by replicating something as frivolous as a signet ring, she owed them an apology. Yes, an apology will undeniably help them sleep at night. Flick paused at the new voice in her head. It was Arthi's, dry and empirical, and it was right. She bit her tongue. Reyes pulled the newsboy cap off his bald head. Yes, Casimir. He snapped his fingers at the boy, dragging a pair of crucibles out of the way, suspenders slipping down his shoulders. Toddy, give her what she needs. Jin gestured after the boy, disappearing into the orange-tinted darkness. Ladies first. Legs trembling, hair sticking to her neck, Flick followed him. How did you find me? You weren't at Spindrift, and the markers hadn't been made yet. It was obvious. As for how I knew which foundry to find you at, everyone knows which workshop forged the infamous signet ring, Jin said, and the words roiled in her stomach, making her think of her mother. Toddy gave her a crucible and helped her gather the things she needed to set up a miniature foundry in Razor's second-floor office, privy to the collective heat of the furnaces and the bellows of machines and men alike. He lit a pair of lanterns and stepped back, adjusting his suspenders and clasping his small hands in front of him. Thank you, she said. She knew she should thank Jin too, for saving her, for letting her walk out of this place alive. The boy didn't respond to her thanks the way she expected him to. He jerked a fearful nod, struggled to meet her eyes, and then darted away. Jin laughed darkly. And that's how you know you're one of us. Flick dabbed at her forehead with a kerchief. If that was what it meant to be respected in the underworld, she wasn't sure she liked it. She dipped her hand into her pocket, pressing her fingers to the edges of her lighter. She didn't dislike it either. She brushed her fingers down her side, feeling each of her ribs with newfound gratitude. When she looked up, Jin's gaze was following the movement. She drew out her lighter and toyed with the flame. On, off, on, off. Again and again until her mind was fire. She had always believed there was something beautiful in the way a fire could start from nothing and rise into a beast. It told her that anything was possible. It told her that no matter how dark the world might be, all it needed was a spark. She would start by thanking him and regaining some sense of humanity. She raised her eyes to his as the lighter snapped on. He flinched. Flick paused at that flash of something old and bruised. She tucked it back into her pocket and got to work, pulling the Aetherian marker from her pocket and easing it into a fresh mould. I'm sorry was what she thought she should say. But Reyes was wrong. Tootle was wrong. It wasn't because of her that Reyes had lost a finger. How could they see a slew of cloaked men and make that connection? Jin rounded the table, leaning down with his palms on either side. She waited for him to speak of her mother. She waited for him to tell her what she refused to believe. Are you hurt? Her hands slipped at the gentle words. Molten metal hissed like liquid fire. Jin yanked his hands away from the table and exhaled a careful breath. Why was he jittery? It was making her jittery. She smoothed the imprint of the numbers from her moulds before they could set, and stood back, waving the heat from her face. What if Reyes had connected the incident to her for no reason other than because he could? Flick stopped and faced Jin, hoping he wouldn't see the sting of tears in her eyes. I know what you're thinking, and I can't bear it. Her voice broke midway, but she forced the rest of the words out of her mouth.
I'm thinking I might go back down there and break some bones,
Jin said. Oh, she didn't condone violence, but perhaps because she was shaken and not entirely herself, the words, and the anger with which he spoke them, gave her an exquisite thrill.
No, it's all right, she said. Let them be.
Jin said nothing. Flip completed the rest of her work in silence, melting, casting, and degassing each piece. It took hours, and though Jin waited patiently with her, an eye to their surroundings, it would take longer still for the markers to be ready. So she gathered what she needed on a tray and left behind what she hoped was enough duven as payment. Jin gestured toward the doorway and followed her down the open staircase, metal steps clanging beneath their footfalls. The foundryman fell quiet as she passed. Ray stared after her. Too Tall did the same. Jin's umbrella was loose in his grip, and she wanted to tell him it wasn't her. She wanted to tell them all it wasn't her. It was only a ring. Her mother would never react in such a way. But deep down, she knew that wasn't true. That night, Flick dreamed about her mother's forgiveness, pressing the ledger into her mother's hands, the sound of newsboys on every street. Lady Linden exposes the ram. The dream careened quickly, flinging her into Razor's foundry. She saw his four-fingered hand. Too Tall, he might never walk again. Flick woke up drowning in guilt, reopening that gaping emptiness she hadn't felt in days. She sighed and dressed herself in her room in Spindrift. The markers she'd replicated were spread across the surface of the writing desk in the corner. She oxidized and rubbed each one down until they looked naturally aged, trying to distract herself with the work. They were her best forgeries yet, and she tried to take pride in the results as she headed downstairs to the others. Arthi said hello. Matteo sipped blood from a teacup, and Jin glanced up from his work. It was a heavy glance, too serious and too concerned. Had he changed his mind and sided with the foundryman? Was there even a side to choose here? She selfishly wished they were alone. Flick set her markers on the counter beside the real one, where the five glimmered beneath the midday sun. These are remarkable, Flick, Matteo said. He ran a thumb along the Aetherian motto. I can barely tell the difference. Flick warmed at the compliment. That's because there isn't one, Jin called. Flick warmed even more and felt tears prickle behind her eyes. Perhaps he didn't hate her. But that wasn't the only thing that was making her emotional, was it? He had done more than save her life. He'd made her part of something. For the first time, she felt truly appreciated, recognized, needed. His tools ground to a halt over something that was gunmetal silver. Stray sparks dusted the plate of pastry crumbs next to him and painted the elegant tattoos on the side of his neck in gold. She couldn't see much of it, but it looked mostly like a bird, a stork or a crane, maybe even a heron. But the design was more stylized than realistic, so it was hard to tell for certain. Thank you, she said to him, for yesterday. He looked like he wanted to ask her a question, but the last thing she wanted was to explain what had happened to the others. To her relief, he only winked. I'll let you know what you owe me. Her cheeks heated, and she stepped away before she made a fool of herself. She straightened the markers and snuck another glance at him. Specs, Arthi explained, even though Flick was looking at Jin and not what he was making. Jin will wear them. If we can't bring anything inside with us, we'll have to find another way. The frame will be sharp enough to cut through the glass covering the chutes transporting the markers. That's very smart, Flick remarked, imagining gin in glasses. Her face was suddenly even hotter. That's very gin, Arthi said. She weighed each marker against the real one, but she ought to have known that Flick was good at her job. Arthi met her eyes, and it was like Flick had said her thoughts aloud. I like to be careful. Laith brushed past, observing Arthi with the intensity of a hawk. Flick saw Matteo noting it. It was hard not to watch Arthi Casimir. The way she worked and schemed, at times as still as stone, other times as restless as a bee. For the most part, Arthi obscured her femininity. She was, after all, a girl in a man's world. But it snuck through every once in a while, when she turned a certain way, when she lit up at Jin's words or countered Matteo's provocations or slid a glance at Laith. When the waves of her hair caught the light, illuminating the copper of her skin and making her gaze come alive with mischief. Don't worry, Flick said to Matteo. They hate each other. He said nothing for a long minute. Neither knows it yet. Flick didn't know what that meant, but she was pleased to see Arthi setting the markers away with care, her inspection complete. Laith surveyed them, glancing from Arthi's desk to Jin's. Seems everyone's contributing but the vampire. I'm elevating the crew with my looks, Matteo said matter-of-factly. You, on the other hand, no one likes a baby tyrant breathing down their necks. Something fell with a tink on the other side of the room. Then a tool clattered onto the table. Will the lot of you quiet down? Jin snapped. Arthi wasn't fazed by his outburst. Anything to help you return to serenade in Flick? Flick flushed. You shouldn't tease. I shouldn't do a lot of things, Arthi said, and nodded at Laith. This one would be out of a job then. You flatter yourself too much, Laith said. This time something shattered. Jin went still. Glass glittered on the floorboards by his feet. What part of keeping mum do you not seem to understand? He snarled. You never said not to talk, Matteo pointed out. Flick peered at Jin's work table. Narrow tools were scattered near a shallow bowl of water and a small pile of glass discs, the lenses for his fake specs. She was fairly certain the ribbon length of angled metal he was trying to wrap around each one was tungsten carbide. She'd worked with it before. Jin angrily grabbed a dustpan. Well, listen here, you overgrown mosquito. Shut up. This time Arthi laughed, and Jin immediately softened. She turned to Matteo and Laith. We're done here for now. I'll scout out the tower tonight, and we'll reconvene tomorrow for the job. Ouch, darling. I know a dismissal when I see one, Matteo said, but he didn't tease her beyond that, and turned to Laith. The guard scowled. Don't touch me. Easy there, Captain Boy. That's the last thing I'll ever do. Trust me, Matteo said, and Flick thought she caught a flash of fangs again before the two of them finally left the room. Arthi crouched beside Jin and picked up a fallen pair of pliers. You've got this, she said gently, and Flick was surprised by this tender side of her. She wondered if Arthi knew she was still in the room with them. Do I? Jin asked. The specs? She asked. Yes, the only reason you think you don't is because you're worrying about everything else. Like how we might die tomorrow? He asked. Precisely, Arthi said lightly. Doubt is of the devil. More often than not, you are the devil, Jin replied. Don't stare, Flick commanded herself. But it was hard not to. His sleeves were rolled up to his forearms, which were corded with veins, charting a path to his hands. He ran his fingers through his mussed hair and cleaned the intact lens with the edge of his shirt. Her throat made a funny sound when she glimpsed a sliver of skin. He slid the specs on his face, one finger adjusting them up the bridge of his nose. He was always stately and trim, but goodness, the specs were something else. Possibly because he'd fashioned them himself.
Dulce periculum, brother, was all Arthi said, poking her finger playfully through the empty half of the frame.
He sighed, but lifted his right hand and knocked the back of it against the back of hers, their knuckles rapping.
We're made for trouble, you and me.
Flick envied them. Their camaraderie, their friendship, their love. They were bound without blood. A bond not unlike hers and her mother's, and yet they couldn't be more different. And it made Flick wonder, then, what exactly she wanted from her mother, if not this.
22. Arthi. There's a way to manifest insignificance. Stand on top of the world. On the balcony at the top of the old Roaring Tower, less than 24 hours before the Festival of Night, Arthi unzipped the maintenance uniform that had gotten her through the guarded entrance and tossed it aside, readjusting the cuffs of her shirt and smoothing out her trousers. Jin had only winked when Arthi asked how he had managed to swipe it. Far below, the city lay awake even this late, gaslights glowing like abandoned wishes. People turned in circles until they found an eternal home of dirt, or a pair of fangs. Buildings tumbled in chaotic disarray, balustrades like sentinels, stone carved upon stone, ending where the sea spilled into the mist, far beyond or emptied into the river Tamisus, winding through half of Atenia. Wind whipped at her hair, ruffling the panels of her suit jacket and tugging at the laces of her shoes. The moonlight bathed half of her in white, the other half in stark shadow. Fitting for what she was. Half here and now, the other half lost at sea, ravaged by an ache that could never be dulled. Please, the ripping wind seemed to beg. Please, please, please. Below her, the clock ticked on, counting through the second hour. A bird took flight from a nest on the number 9, and she shivered as the tower's pulse became her own. It was a mechanical heartbeat that measured life in seconds, counting time the way mortals rarely did. Tell me, do you remember what it's like to live? Those words had pierced her skin and burrowed under her muscles, settling into her bones. Just like the boy who had spoken them. And there, in the indiscernible silence, she heard it. The low draw of a breath. Arthi spun. A figure was silhouetted behind her. She sprang forward and shoved him against the brick wall, finger dropping to the trigger of her pistol. He broke her hold and reversed their positions within the single strike of the clock. He tilted his head, locks of white falling across his right eye.
Your aggression grows increasingly violent.
There was a reason for that aggression. The fact that he was in her head before he appeared behind her. The fact that she couldn't stop thinking of him and how he'd held her, touched her, looked at her. How she planned on getting him killed.
Let go of me, Arthi said quietly.
Her arm was caged beneath his knee pressed between hers, locking her in place. Her body itched to lean closer, to brush against him. A current was shooting through her veins. She was angry, that was it. There was no possibility of the low, silken thrum of his voice having any other effect on her. Or else, he asked, slipping closer until the tip of his nose almost touched hers. His smile was the edge of a knife, and she was ready to bleed. He smelled like smoke and wood and spice, a mystery twined with enchantment.
You're in no position to make threats, Casimir.
The night gusted between them. She drew her lip between her teeth. Was it the shift of the moon, or did his eyes darken?
Was it the clock that thrummed down her body? Or was it something else? Arthi let herself linger in the heat flooding through her limbs, feeling powerful when his gaze dropped to her mouth. She shoved him off her, immediately curling her fists against the feel of his skin beneath his clothes, the solidity of his chest. It wasn't hard to conjure the image of him at his apartment, his torso bare, skin glistening with stray drops of water. He had discarded his robes today in favour of a linen shirt, in royal blue, that fit snug across his shoulders with billowy pants slung low. He looked even more bare without his kitten curled on his shoulder. Arthi rounded to the other side of the balcony, biting her tongue to force herself back to her senses. "What are you doing here?" Arthi studied him, the smooth mask of indifference, the bow of his lips that made her skin prickle. There, the quick twitch of his eyes every few heartbeats. A ruptured piece, an unsettled heart. Strangely, it eased something inside of her, made her less hostile, which wasn't a good thing. "I thought it would be smart to survey the Aetherium from above," he replied. "I didn't expect to find you here." She wondered if he'd used his rank as a captain to get inside, or if he'd scaled the tower itself. She wouldn't be surprised if it was the latter. "Oh, because I'm not smart?" she asked. He started to protest before he caught sight of her teasing smirk and laughed, rich and warm, and she latched onto the sound as if it were the sequence to a vault. He studied her with something like respect, throwing her off kilter once again. Nothing about Laith slotted into place, and perhaps that was why she found herself thinking about him again and again, puzzling him out, trying to decipher the secrets that lurked behind the tenebrous dark of his eyes. "How did you find such confidence?" he asked. "Finding it suggests I had no part in its making." When she had, she'd fed it into her veins, nurtured it from stilted first steps to a wizened stalk. The Aetherium spanned across the tower's shadow, the wall carving a white perimeter, narrow and slick. The establishment dripped decadence, from the details carved into the stone to the roof glinting like duvin, ripe for the taking. Vampires lingered in the garden, aglow with the light from inside, their conversations as low as they would be in Spindrift. Closer to Arthi and Laith, a guard paced in the dormer balcony cut into the Aetherium roof. Half of his platform extended out of the Aetherium, giving him a view of the gardens, and she could see the other half, a mezzanine that extended farther inside, where Matteo said he surveyed the entrance. "Now there's a guard who doesn't slack off," Laith said. A glint of metal hung from the guard's waist beside a spool of silver. Arthi gestured to it. "We'll have to take him out with his own weapon." Aetherium guards were equipped with barbed wire and specially designed guns that fired without a sound. They were meant for vampires. The bullets dissolved shortly after contact and unleashed a toxin that would knock one out for a good 10 minutes, and a human indefinitely. She nodded at the gates, where two guards monitored the crowd gliding in and out. "We'll pilfer a gun from one of them and shoot the dormer guard. That gives us 10 minutes. Once Flick gets into the Aetherium and inserts our identifiers, you'll follow, scale the interior wall and secure him with his own coil of barbed wire before the toxin wears out."
"Barbed wire," Laith deadpanned. "What good will that do?"
"Wrap it tightly enough, and it will keep him immobilized and quiet until the shift change comes looking for him the next morning. They move, they bleed. He opens his mouth, it cuts into his lips. Vampires might be powerful, but the bullet drains them, and they won't risk bleeding dry. Vampires can't produce blood."
"And how do you know all of this?"
he asked. "I listen. Spindrift was designed to pacify, and people like to talk when they feel safe. Arthi said,
I would.
Shh. Laith cut her off. Footsteps. They echoed behind the clock face. Voices called to one another. The tower guards. She had known her maintenance ruse wouldn't last, but with Laith here, she'd overstayed. The balcony was one flat bed of stone, corralled by a balustrade, and there was no place to hide. They couldn't jump without breaking their necks or make the climb down before they were spotted. Laith gave her his hand.
What?
Arthi asked.
You don't have to trust me.
I don't. The doorknob rattled. The auction was less than a day away. She didn't have time to take chances. She had prepared too much to let it fall apart. She took his hand as the door flung open.
You ludicrous.
You would know,
he said with a quick grin and swung her over the ledge of the clock tower balcony. The world toppled. She was hurtling through the air, a shout cramming into her throat. She was held aloft by nothing but Laith's arm around her middle until he dropped them both into the nook of a narrow window, just beside the curve of the first hour. Arthi bristled.
Was there...
Hush! He cut her off again, clearly enjoying himself. Him and his flowers and his white kitten and those wretched flecks above his brow. The narrow nook, Arthi belatedly realized, really was very narrow. He brought his fingers to the small of her back, then leaned into the star-studded sky and peered up to the balcony. The guards' voices echoed, but Arthi couldn't hear them. Not with her body pressed against his and the breadth of his shoulders engulfing her. Not with the hammer of his heart inches from her ear so she could count each beat.
They won't find us here,
Laith murmured, pulling back into the shadow of the nook, and his pulse quickened like horses beneath a whip, a vein thrumming at his neck. Fissures of amber shimmered in his irises.
This is the part where you thank me.
If I ever do, you'll know that something is very wrong, she replied, fighting to remain in control of herself. The rumble of his responding, echoed down to her toes. He was studying her, and Arthi had the sinking realization that he knew exactly how he was affecting her. Why else did a smirk lift the side of his mouth when he leaned even closer? Quick as a shot, his thumb brushed the swell of her lower lip, leaving fire in its wake, and she thought she felt the hand at the small of her back tug her closer. She thought she allowed it.
What are you doing?
She told herself she asked because she needed to know. There was no other reason why she sought out the sound of his voice when every space in her mind was already allotted for, each one working through a task, a job, mulling white-roaring secrets.
What are we doing, Arthi?
He murmured with half a groan, and the night lit a fever in his eyes. She didn't know why his use of the word we made her shiver. She wondered what she had to do to hear that barely restrained hint of a groan again.
Is it mayhem or desire?
He asked, slowly sliding his hands up her arms. It was both. It was something kindred. For Arthi, one was often synonymous with the other. But right now, she couldn't breathe. Every inch of her wanted to throw herself at him. Every inch of her wanted to put as much distance as possible between them. Up above, the door to the balcony slammed closed.
Soon, she told herself.
She'd retrieve that ledger and be done with him. Be done with this. And if any part of her did not look forward to the fact, she buried it deep.
Act 2. Past and Future. 23. Jin. Jin had planned his outfit for the Ethereum job days ago. His jacket was finely spun velvet in the deepest green he could find. It would seem colourless to anyone who was tasteless,
fashionable to anyone who mattered. He had even dabbed on cologne, more so to find comfort in the blend of bergamot and cashmere, but still. The heist was tonight. There was a chance he might die, but there was also the utmost certainty that he would do so in style. He set his umbrella against the sideboard with a heavy sigh, already feeling like he was missing a limb, a little part of his childhood that made him him. He wasn't excited to call in that favour, to see Rose Ashby and be reminded yet again of how he'd killed for her. He could lie and steal and coax without hesitation, break bones and shatter jaws as quickly as a shot. But killing was killing, and Jin wasn't fond of it. The Ashbys were a family of vampires, and not by choice, as most vampire families tended to be, but by actual kinship. Once the patriarch of the family had turned, Jin guessed he couldn't bear the thought of his spouse and children aging without him, and so he turned them one by one, waiting until each child reached the age he wanted to preserve. To some, it was romantic. A family forever united. To Jin, it was heinous. It was one thing to be born without the privilege of money and standing. It was another to live without the power to make a decision for oneself. To have control forcefully taken from one's hands. To understand the true meaning of helplessness. Rose Ashby was nothing like her father. She was kind and real, a rarity in a world made up of superficial and materialistic people. When she'd come to Jin 2 years ago, asking him to make sure her still-human, critically ill brother never left the hospital a vampire, he couldn't say no. Not when there were fates worse than death. So no, he wasn't excited about the reminder of what he'd done. But if there was any way to get into the Ethereum as a blood companion and bypass the vetting process, it was with Rose Ashby. She was the closest thing to vampire royalty. It was a little past 8 when he left his room in Spindrift and went downstairs to where Laith and Arthi were running through the plans one last time. Flick was in one of the booths by the window. Her gown was as pretty as a garden at dawn. It was a warm shade of cream, like well-made milk tea. A heavy smattering of flowers were embroidered along the hem, gradually fading up to a laced bodice that cupped her every curve in a way that made Jin jealous, ending with a delicate collar around her throat. She tilted her head and peered at him as if she were compiling his chapters into a book and something didn't tally, as if he were broken and only she could see it. But Jin was the one who fixed things. He knew what was broken. And it sure wasn't him. It couldn't be. Nope. Moonlight pooled in Flick's hair, tracing each ringlet like the hand of an earnest lover, gradually drifting to outline her profile in dusky silver. She looked at the stars as if they were home, and he wished, impossibly, that he could take her to them.
Oh, hello, she said when he neared. I like your glasses.
Jin couldn't stop a boyish smile.
Why, thank you, Felicity.
Flick nodded, barely holding his gaze.
Also your tattoos. Why, what are they?
His smile turned into a grin.
Going to ask all the questions now, are we?
She ducked adorably into the collar of her dress. And then that damned lighter was in her hand again. She slowed her movements, but didn't tuck it away.
I've seen your arm, she said softly. I can tell you're not fond of fire.
Jin gritted his teeth.
But it's okay.
She looked up at him.
It really is.
Jin latched onto the rise and fall of her voice, the measured sounds of her breaths. She watched him for a moment and finally capped the little thing.
It's funny, I think, how a flame has the opposite effect on me. It calms me, Sometimes I think even vampires hunt for the flame. For the light. It's what we need to live. Undead or otherwise, isn't it? I know it marked a terrible part of your life, Jin. But that doesn't mean you can't overcome it.
Perhaps, Jin said.
For certain, she said, and the belief in her voice soothed him. Jin released a slow breath.
It's a heron.
Her brow pinched in confusion. My tattoo, he said, tugging his collar away so she could get a better look at it.
It's a heron.
When I was a child, I had a stubborn tuft of hair right at the back here that would never stay down. And my mother joked that I looked like a black heron they'd seen on one of their voyages. My father would always call me Little Heron after that. Do you still miss them? Flick said.
Every day, Jin said quietly, and saw the notch between her brows.
You're the same. You miss your mother. That notch deepened. I thought I did. Spindrift's door swung open in a jangle of bells, and a figure stepped inside with a satisfied sigh, wiping something dark off his chin. Chester darted forward.
We're closed! Bugger off!
But Jin knew that swagger, even if he didn't recognize the rest of the man. Mateo? Arthi asked. Flick rose to her feet.
Bang up the elephant. I almost didn't recognize you.
I do clean up nice, don't I?
Mateo asked, his lips curling a crooked grin at Arthi.
Don't stare, darling.
He hadn't cleaned up. He had changed. His hair was as bright as Chester's now, bound loosely at the base of his skull. A pair of gold-framed specs sat on the bridge of his nose, his signature half-open ruffled white shirt, now as dark as sin, and matched by his trousers. Laith crossed his arms.
Can the two of you focus? Yalla.
Flick lifted a hand to her mouth, chagrined. For once, Jin agreed with the High Captain. But Arthi would never admit to staring.
Your drawings had better be right.
Mateo hummed.
This will work. Trust a little.
That was the problem, wasn't it? She didn't trust anyone. Jin sometimes wondered if she even trusted him.
The auction begins at 10, she said, striding for the door. We reconvene at 3:15.
Laith, you are not bringing that kitten with you.
Oh, I am, he replied. After me, she's the stealthiest in our crew.
Jin studied Arthi. She was off. Her eyes looked almost hollow. Something wild and hungry lurking in the umber.
Our 10-minute window begins once I take down the Dormer Guard. And no, Mateo, he won't die.
I'll be knocking him out.
Flick then needs to enter the archive room and get everyone in.
Laith follows. Mateo brings up the rear, distracting the entrance crowd so Laith can scale the wall and apprehend the guard before he wakes up and sounds the alarm for being knocked out. Then he and I will search for the ledger while Jin and Flick keep the auction going.
Are we clear? Jin asked.
Nods went around.
Listen for the bells, Arthi reminded. And don't die, Jin joked.
That's the one thing I haven't mastered, Mateo said with a dramatic sigh. When Mateo and Flick turned for the door, Arthi pulled Calibor from her waist. Jin watched as it shifted into a sharp-edged hairpin, that strange magic unsettling him even now. She flipped it over in her hands and held Laith's gaze for a fraction of a second too long, before she secured it through her hair. Laith knew. She had told him. A thread of uncertainty snaked through Jin. It was not jealousy, but fear. Worry. And finally, apprehension. Because Arthi never revealed a secret unless she had a bigger one waiting right behind it. She saw Jin watching her.
Ready? She asked him.
No, he answered honestly,
swallowing his many questions, because now wasn't the time.
Perfect, Arthi smiled,
and it shouldn't have made it easier for Jin to breathe, but it did. She stepped out into the night.
It's tea time, scoundrels.
24. Arthi. The Ethereum cut a startling figure in the dark, tucked behind its alabaster wall. Arthi hadn't run a large job in a while. She'd never run a job this large, and she'd almost forgotten what it was like to move from plan to execution. That rush of emotion, that fear and excitement warring with each other. She watched as Jin disappeared through the Ethereum's imposing iron gates with a saunter in his step, looking every bit like he belonged in the swarm of vampires lounging in the gardens. No one spared him a glance. Tiny lights were strung from the trees, illuminating the latest in undead fashion, with necklines deeper than what was decent, skirts slit sharp as knives. Vampires left shame in the grave when they returned, their attire more provocative than what high society would even deem appropriate for sleepwear. Flick followed, tucked between two members of the press as instructed, and then Laith. Behind them all, Arthi fell in step with a group of vampires making their way to the Ethereum. She kept her head low, spirits rising as she got closer and closer to the gates. The cold nipped at her ears, but she wished the moon would tuck itself behind some clouds right about now. One of the guards was attentive. The other was deep in conversation with a guest. All she had to do was bump into the distracted one and slip his gun out of his holster. She veered closer to him.
Oi!
It was the attentive guard. Drat. Arthi kept walking, pretending she couldn't hear.
I know you.
And if he kept yapping about it, everyone else would too. Gritting her teeth, Arthi broke away from the group and detoured to him.
You're that Casimir.
He was yellow-haired and dark-eyed and fully irritating. Arthi recalled everything Chester had gathered on him.
And you're Barclay.
The guard narrowed his eyes, but he'd quieted down, and they weren't getting as many stares anymore. Still, he would know she wasn't from the press, or even an enthusiast, and the last thing she needed was for him to demand he see her marker and ruin the job before it even began. She came prepared.
You'll have to tell me if these sound familiar,
Arthi said, stepping closer to him and the gun at his waist.
Prussic acid, lead carbonate, arsenic, tough stuff.
He drew himself to his full height and bared his teeth.
Ah, she warned, seeing through his thick skull. You don't want me to go missing.
It's a side job, all right, he said. I stocked the local apothecary.
Not everyone here oozes money.
Strange, Arthi said with a frown. Through the gate, she could see the Ethereum gardens and the crowds thickening. She needed to move.
Madame Mabel didn't own an apothecary last I checked.
The vampire stilled, in effigy under the moonlight. There was more than one grifter on the streets of White Roaring, and if Arthi culled secrets, at least she duped her patrons with something healthy in a cup. Madame Mabel ever killed them. Slowly. She couldn't care less about the effects of the toxicants she used in her cosmetics, so long as they had immediate results and took long enough to rot her high-paying customers.
How much does Beautiful Forever pay you for the poison Mabel uses in her opulent cosmetics, stripping Atenia's beauties to their bones? She asked.
He huffed. Enough. Arthi nodded.
Thought so. But I'm not one to get in the way of a good transaction. So if you'll turn around, I'll be on my way.
There really was little difference between Atenia's undead guards and the living ones. One had bones that could be snapped in two.
The other boasted bones well nigh made of stone. Both were small-brained folk in tinsel suits.
You think I'm going to let you through?
He sounded baffled.
As a matter of fact, I know you are, Arthur replied, unless you want your work history to find its way out. I'm just here to be a part of the excitement.
He clenched his teeth and glared, but finally relented, and he was so busy seething that he didn't notice Arthur striding past the gates with his now missing gun.